We need to start adding in one of these calls a week where it's not a podcast, where we can get through all of the
yeah, literally
the
just like we just I, yeah, we just we honestly we just need to schedule in a weekly gossip. I think
did we just discover hanging out?
We've worked backwards from podcast to hanging out.
We've invented friends from first principles. Damn.
I hope you guys were both recording that, because that is going in at the start of the episode. Hello and welcome to yet another edition of Masters of Our Domain, the podcast that was once about the hit 90s sitcom Seinfeld, and as for the previous 43 minutes, been entirely about salacious gossip that we cannot leave in the episode. So this is, you're sort of joining us mid-episode, really, listener. I'm Milo Edwards, and I'm joined, as ever, by my co-host Patrick Wellman and Phoebe Roy. How are we doing?
Yeah, we're doing okay. I've got a sore throat. I don't feel well.
Oh no. How did that not come up in the last 40 minutes of us talking?
I don't know. It didn't feel like high priority.
Well, yeah. So Phoebe, your sore throats are always high priority, I think we need to get those in at the very beginning.
Thank you. I've been doing my TCP gargling, but so far it's still with me.
I don't know what that is. Yeah. And
it sounds like something that happens in the gay community.
I mean, it is a gay cure for tonsillitis.
Really? Does it come with like a rainbow flag? Is there performative allyship involved? Like, how does this walk me through this?
If your tonsils are rainbow, you really need to get to a doctor.
No, it does go to a low quality techno event on a Sunday afternoon.
Sure.
But then that would be like mostly straight tonsillitis with just enough gay people there to make them feel like they were a gay thing.
Exactly. Like straight day at the gay sauna. Discussed on this show. Pass him. do you not? I still think that's the funniest thing Milo's ever said.
What, straight hour at the gay sauna?
Yeah. Because it's like bring your kid Unhappy to work hour. Day. It's like bring your straight friend.
Yeah.
So that they can like see what happens at the gay sauna. Don't
yeah,
know if
they
you know
put
what...
up a big sign for an hour that's like no funny stuff. It's like the
you're not really an ally until you've been to the sauna.
Yeah. They turn all the gay porn over to like QVC. Yeah.
Just put on ESPN yeah. and SportsCenter highlights.
Business attire. Jackets and ties in the sauna.
First of all, how is it possible that when you're trying to think of the straightest thing you can imagine, you come up with QVC? Is that honestly what's in your head as like straight culture?
Well, I was sort of deliberately like it would be like something neutral but also weird, because it has to be something that's like on all the time, you know?
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, you couldn't put on like BBC Two or something. Like the vibe would keep shifting too much between like Homes Under the Hammer and like Australian border control. Like it needs to be something like the Shopping Channel, so that it's kind of like a consistent background hum.
What is the Australian border control?
You know what, Pat? We don't have time.
Oh, baby.
is this like the Hunger Games for trying to get into Australia and they televise it?
It's where we search a lot of Asian people.
Yeah, pretty much.
It's and we like, say you can't bring coriander into Australia. That's very clearly on the sign.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, and occasionally someone will have like a peg soapy. Leg full of cocaine or something.
that's pretty cool.
Yeah, pretty sick.
Yeah, do neither of you know what TCP is?
No.
It is a pharmaceutical disinfectant. I think it's French TCP, but if you dilute it down in warm water and gargle with it, it's a really really effective guard against the sore throat that you get specifically with tonsillitis, because it just like kills all the bacteria and gunk around your tonsils.
Interesting.
If you make it a bit too strong, it really really hurts, but like the kind of the burning feels better than a sore throat, and then you finish that off with a warm salt water gargle. I've got a whole gargle system.
I don't know how long we lost each other for there.
What was the last thing that you heard me say?
you had a full blown gargling regimen.
Yeah, and then I said you've got a nighttime throat care routine. You're the original throat goat. That was mine.
That's good.
I missed that line.
That's good.
That's fucking good. Tragic.
What I said was that I'm like the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. I have this very complicated irrigation system, and nobody knows how it works because I haven't left behind any diagrams.
That makes sense.
The throat of Hammurabi.
Exactly.
I realize a flaw I have as a person is that if my throat hurt, it wouldn't occur to me to do any of those things. I would just be like, oh, I guess my throat hurts. Guess we're living with it.
That's where we are, baby.
Yeah. And then at some point, like several days into it, it would vaguely occur to me that there is a doctor and that I can go to the doctor and they can do things.
Well, in theory, if you're gay.
In theory. if you're willing to attend the techno festival, then yeah, there are things they can do. So do you guys want to talk about, speaking of techno festivals?
Sure.
Do you guys want to talk about Spartacus?
Yeah.
Yeah, baby.
Let's do it.
That was perhaps not the segue we were looking for, but we'll take what we can get.
So I missed out on last week's episode, but I did get to edit it. So, you know, I'm sort of caught up, and I have watched both episodes of Spartacus. And let me tell you, I've never watched so much green screen in my life. I have watched BBC sketch shows with a higher production value than this TV show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is very clearly second tier prestige network in 2009. Mm. I cannot come up with a better description of the aesthetic than that, where it's like, what if we were making 300, but with like a 30th as much money? And I think, to their credit, given the restrictions that they were working with, because I don't think this was not a high budget production at all, I don't believe. They've managed to make it look okay.
They spent all the money on John Hannah. They're like, we need the guy from Sliding Doors.
He's expensive. He's one of the more expensive Hannahs. Daryl Hannah is the budget option.
Yeah. Damn it.
I take that back. I like Daryl Hannah, and I don't think she's the budget option.
No, she's not. She's full price, baby.
She is full price.
Daryl Hannah never on sale.
Yeah, you're not getting Daryl Hannah in the middle of Lidl, let me tell you that.
No.
Or John Hannah, for that matter. So, I wouldn't have thought.
No, absolutely not.
I don't disagree that the green screen, that this show often looks ridiculous.
Mm.
Like, not just not great, but straight up ridiculous. My rejoinder to that is that I think it actually works.
Okay.
Because this show, from the very beginning, even when the episodes themselves are severely lacking in some department, such as dialogue or performance or something
historical accuracy.
Things of this nature.
I'm going to come around to that because there's a lot more that I like than don't as far as the historical accuracy.
The start of the first episode, which I know you've already covered, it looks a lot like the Mighty Boosh. Like, there are so many people dressed up in sort of like scary boogeyman costumes, and I'm like, this surely cannot be what any of these people were wearing. Like, it's not.
Yeah, we're doing Getai racism 2100 years in the future. The Getai were thought to be barbarous. They did live on the wrong side of the Danube. There were a lot of ideas about that existed in the classical world about the people living beyond the Danube, like being like their environment turning them into monsters. Like, this is a pretty consistent idea in Greco-Roman ethnography. But they do some stuff with it. I think we can take some exception to that should we choose to do so.
Mm.
But the reason why I say it works is because I think it's consistent. They have a visual language that they're trying to use. They have a kind of a tone that they're trying to capture. And as long as you're willing to suspend disbelief to get into that world, it actually works.
Mm-hmm.
And I fully understand that there are going to be people who watch this show and it just doesn't work for them. Like, the whether it's the visuals or the kind of the cadence of the dialogue, the way the performances happen, I fully get it. If it's not your thing, I'm not going to blame you for turning it off. But if you can get past the kind of weirdness of those aspects of it, I think there actually is a lot to dig into here that repays the viewer.
I'm sorry, I'm just trying to write a Mighty Boosh style song in the corner here about Spartacus Blood and Sand.
Well, don't let me stop you.
I'm not gonna get over that comparison anytime soon.
My only friend of the
guitar. Oh, look at me. I'm in the arena. I've got a sword, I'm just dancing away.
Yeah, go on, bring that back.
Look at that. You might think I'm wearing a top, but no, I'm not. It's made of somebody else's skin. I'm a cheeky little monkey.
Oh, look, we love it. We love a human skin cloak.
We like a human
really
skin.
It really has the aesthetics of the Mighty Boosh. Like, the special effects are very Boosh. The dialogue is quite Boosh at points.
Yep.
Yeah, it's something.
It really is. And that's one of the things that I like about it is that it is unapologetically batshit. Mm-hmm. Like from the opening scene, this show knows that it's doing something insane, and its basic like kind of offer to the viewer is, if you're in, we're going to do some fun shit. If you're not, get off now, because it's not going to get less like this as it goes on. It's going to get more like it. Yeah. And as long
strap
as you're
in
kind
for
of
how much more like it it's going to get.
Yeah. But, and this was something Phoebe and I talked about last week, at its core, think about what it is, right? And we talked about the parallels with 300 and how this kind of got lumped in with 300 at the time because of the aesthetic, because the aesthetic is so clearly related to that. But it's actually doing the opposite in the sense that 300 is looking at the world from the perspective of an elite group of Spartans with all of their kind of batshit, weird, strange, not real ideas about who they are and their place in the world and them as the mightiest people. And it's totally buying into that viewpoint. That's its orientation toward the ancient world that it purports to depict. Mm. Whereas this show is doing the exact opposite. It is identifying you more than anyone else with the oppressed underclass of society, and it asks you to take their experiences seriously. Now, it heightens that, and it does so in ways that are determinedly lurid and tasteless. It's committed to that. That is its viewpoint on this world, and it lays that out at the very beginning, and it sticks to it through the entire run of the show. That is the way it's deciding to do this. And I think if you can kind of buy into that a little bit, because the reason why I can and why it works for me is because I think it captures something about the kind of garishness and vulgarity of the Roman world. Outside the very elite levels of senators and, you know, Caesar doing this and Pompey doing that, there's this kind of relentless competitive striving and stepping over people and stepping on people to move up that I think gets at the heart of the Roman ethos. Mm-hmm. And not just among the elite, like at every level of society, there's this striving that we see. And the deal that people make in this world is that if you buy into our way of doing things, if you buy into this kind of framework of oppression, we might call it, or framework of oppressive relationships, then you too can get ahead. If you don't buy into it, you never get to get ahead, and you're probably going to end up dead in a ditch somewhere. But if you do buy into it, you can gain status, you can gain power, you can move up as long as you're willing to play the game the way that we want you to. Mm. And there's just something so basic about centering those kinds of characters that I think captures something really essential about the Roman world. And that to me is very compelling. I find that a really worthwhile way of understanding this time and place.
Mm. Okay. Well, Another just question I had quite early on, because I remember studying the Spartacus slave rebellion, the gladiatorial rebellion, whatever you want to call it. But quite early on in my university career, so this is, you know, we're probably talking something in the region of 13 years ago now. But did it or did it not happen in Sicily?
No. That was a different rebellion.
Oh, okay.
So this is the Third Servile War. The Spartacus Rebellion is what's called the Third Servile War.
Okay.
There were two previous major slave rebellions, which were both called Servile Wars, which did take place in Sicily.
Right. Okay.
So there are structural reasons for this, that this is the golden age of mass enslavement and foreign war captives in the Roman world. So there will never again be as many foreign-born people taken in war who are enslaved in the Roman world as there are at this specific point in time, around 70, between about, let's say, 140 and 70 BC is actually the high point of Roman slavery. It's a high point in terms of rebellions against it. It's a high point in terms of the sheer number of enslaved people who are brought in. And it's the high point in terms of the brutality of the institution.
This is what Roman boomers are constantly like having false memories of in about 50 AD. They're like, yeah, no, you can, I'll tell you what, the vigil will just give you a clip round the ear then.
Yeah, with it. This, yes.
We used to drink right out of the sewers.
Yeah.
You can imagine Cicero in like 45 BC, shortly before he gets his hands cut off and nailed to the doors of the forum. Cicero bitching about how you can't treat your slaves the way you used to. Mm. Like, that's a real thing. And the golden age for Roman slave owners really seems to have been this period. It was when they could treat their slaves the worst, they could buy them for the cheapest, they could work them to death without any fear of consequences for that. And it was at its most lucrative.
If we gave anyone any lip, how'd that throw us off the Tarpeian Rock? Never did us any harm.
No. Unless we died. Yeah. I mean, in that case it did. But if we survived...
Yeah, kids were tough then.
It's Rectio Res Publica gone mad.
So that's kind of the essential context for it. Mm. And to the extent that this is speaking to a genuine time in the Roman world, I think it kind of gets that. The sense of sheer exploitation that defines every interaction between an enslaved person and a master in this show highlights the power dynamic. Mm. They're designed to highlight the power dynamic. They're in the script because they highlight the power dynamic. That's the fundamental concern here. And it's pretty laser focused on that. On who gets to do what to whom and how do they justify it. Mm-hmm. And in this episode, I think we get into some really interesting pieces of that once we're in the house of Batiatus and we see what Batiatus is doing and what his goals are. And we see what we could call an ideology of enslavement and slave belonging to the household that comes up in this episode. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of stuff in there that rings true to me. Mm-hmm. As an observer of this period.
I've just remembered this now. And I feel like I have to say it right now. In the first episode, one of the Thracians has an Australian accent. That's just glossed over. There's just a bit where he's like, oh, you can't defy the bloody Romans, mate. I don't know if they're trying to do a bit like Oliver Stone's Alexander, where they're like, if you're a Roman, the Thracians are kind of like Australians. Like,
yeah.
They're coming over here. They love cocaine.
They all live in Earl's Court.
Nice hair, good hair, good long hair, sun bleached hair.
Love a mullet.
Yeah.
I think it's just because of like the sheer number of Australian and New Zealand actors that are in this.
Yeah. But they normally don't let them do the accent.
Well, I mean, some Australians that are not governable in that way. You can't. It's not about letting them do the accent. They're going to do the accent whether you let them or not.
What a wonderful description of Australia.
I believe they're called Queenslanders.
One of the many things that I love about doing this show with you guys is I discover regional and ethnic stereotypes that I never knew existed before.
That's us. We'll phrenologize anyone.
Yeah, I didn't know that there was a Queensland stereotype, and yet here we are. What a lovely thing to discover on a Wednesday morning for me.
You see a guy in the 7-Eleven not wearing shoes, but you know you're in Queensland, brother.
None of this sounds bad to me. Sounds like, these sound like my people.
No, Queensland's pretty fun. It's like redneck country, you know? It's like...
Again, my people.
Yeah.
Okay, so... Do you want to talk about the structure of the slave household real quick?
Sure.
All right. So the core thing that happens in this episode is, plot-wise, is Spartacus enters the house of Batiatus. Mm. He becomes a gladiator. We see the trials that he goes through in order to become a gladiator. There's what we could call it kind of like an initiation process where they're getting trained pretty much to death, and then they're getting branded. With a B for Batiatus, we see that the House of Batiatus is an institution that has existed now it's now in its third generation. Mm. Our guy Batiatus comes from a long line of trainers of gladiators, and what I think this gets right is the sense of identity among the enslaved that develops around the master's household. Mm-hmm. When because the gladiators are talking about that, you know, they're titans. They are representatives of the house of Batiatis. This is their main point of reference for identity.
I was just clear.
Gladiators very rarely leave the house of Batiatis, and when they do, it's generally for huge transfer fees. More of a cult than a club, really.
Yeah, that's kind of the vibe, is that when you take all of these people and you shear them away quite intentionally from every tie that they've had that defines them, which is the essence of slavery in the classical world, the way that masters replace that is by highlighting the sense of allegiance to the master's household that these slaves are now a part of. Right. Like, they've lost all of their previous associations. They've lost their ethnic identity. They've often lost their language. They've lost their family. They've lost their kin group, tribe. All of the things that made them who they were are now gone. And what they're left with is the household of the master. And that becomes a really powerful focus of identity for enslaved people. And the more powerful the enslaver is, the more powerful the master is, the stronger that sense of association tends to be.
When you're fighting dressed up as a fish god, you are representing this gladiatorial school, so tuck your shirt in.
Yeah, you're riffing, but yes, that is exactly the vibe of slavery in the Roman world. It's that the doctore, the actual trainer, the guy who's out there, you know, telling them how to be gladiators, he says, "Your will, my hands." And this is, and to the extent that it becomes a joke that Batiatis repeats back when he's frustrated later in the episode. But again, that is a real kind of understanding of how Roman slavery worked, that the enslaved person is a thinking tool. They are an extension of the person of the master who owns them.
It's like living, like living in London and working in the media, everyone just asking each other what school they went to.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of parallels to that. And you can
Everyone lying in different ways and in different directions.
Slow grammar, mate.
I'm actually a slave of the Imperial household.
Arsenal fans in my Instagram comments.
Oh my god. I have not
Arsenal
stopped laughing
fans
about
in your
that.
Instagram comments all just being like, "No, I fought with a short sword. You know."
The one
you
guy
take
whose
that
picture
back
was
my camembert.
The one guy whose picture was of him on a yacht and was trying to.
it's so perfect. It's almost as if you've been set up. To be honest with you,
it's beyond parody.
Yeah,
I was killing.
Expecting Jeremy Beadle to appear at any moment.
But yeah, I mean, this is why in the Roman world, if you want to have like a big business, you have to use enslaved people as your agents in the business, because a free person cannot represent another one. You can't be an extension of another free person. That's a basic violation of kind of the sense of what makes a person free, is you cannot act on behalf of another person like that. A slave can. And so that little phrase that they come up with, "my will, your hands," which I don't believe is reflected in the sources. I think it's something the writers came up with and put in this script. That is actually an outstanding reflection of the basic Roman understanding of the position of enslaved person with regard to their master. That's actually a perfect encapsulation of it.
I love how seriously you are engaging with a TV show where quite a lot of the exposition in this particular episode is done through watching John Hannah receive a blowjob while his wife receives a similar scene to, and they're
a
just
similar scene to an SST.
Exactly. Yeah, that's what they call it.
Sounds like something you pick up on a stag do.
Yeah. There's a lot of things in this episode that are quite stag do goat.
There are. But again, I'm going to defend it, and I'm going to tell you why. Because the way they shot that scene, right, where Batiatis and what's Lucy Lawless's character's name?
Lucy Lawless. You don't need to give her a name. She's just Lucy Lawless. And we also have
Lucia Senelegius.
We also have Lucy True, Lucy Lawless Neutral. We have Lucy Evil Lawless. Mm-hmm. We have Lucy True
Lucy
Lawless.
Chaotic Neutral. Yeah. That's,
We have Chaotic Lawless, which is which we saw in this.
That, in that, what's really striking to me about that scene and the way they shot it is how unsexy it is for everyone except the two masters. Mm. It's literally just manual labor for the enslaved people who are in the room. And they're basically treated as if they are not there otherwise. Like they're just a pair of hands or a mouth.
Oh, that's oral labor. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. But this is
like podcasting.
Yeah. But this is, again, this is really how Roman elites thought of enslaved people. That they were just around. They were just there to be a pair of hands to do a thing. They weren't people, right? Mm. They're not. And the way that they're
going
talking
to work
in
at the dick sucking factory was a real thing in ancient Rome.
It is. That's the really fucked up part. That's not an exaggeration. There really was if you were rich enough and you had, and this is the golden age of rich people having hundreds or thousands of enslaved people at their beck and call. If you were a rich guy, you really could just have a slave to get you warmed up. You would purchase someone for that specific purpose, and that's what they're there for. And that's the world that you live in. And think about how fucking poisoning that is to your understanding of people. Mm. That's the essence of the Roman world. Mm. And this show gets at that kind of dark, nasty, exploitative thing, I think, really, really, really directly and clearly. And if you're not paying attention, you just get stuck on the sex and not the power dynamics. And this show's all about the power dynamics.
Walking into fuck my wife like a professional boxer in an open robe with like a team of young boys wanking me off.
There's
rubbing my shoulders, you know, like putting talc on me.
They're called the Fluffatus.
Sorry.
It's called the Fluffatus. It's a particular.
It's actually attested in the graffiti from Pompeii. Mm. There's a scene in the second season of this show, which we will talk about, I'm sure, once we get there. Very early in the second season, where they're the gladiatorial slaves, once they've escaped from the house of Batiatus, which, I'm sorry, spoiler alert, it's the basic story of the Spartacus rebellion here. Mm-hmm. They attack a villa and they're going to free the slaves who are in the villa. And the shot that we get when they're going up to the villa is the master of the house having sex with a female slave. And he turns to the male slave and he says, "Insert cock and ass, I would finish." And ridiculous bit of dialogue, ridiculous premise to be the thing that they're showing us with this house that they're about to raid. Also a perfect encapsulation of
you thought
just
he was
how
straight
fucked,
wrong.
No, but just a perfect encapsulation of how fucked up Roman slavery was.
Mm, yeah.
There are all of these things in this show that seem so absurd and so ridiculous. And I actually think the more absurd and ridiculous the things seem, the truer they are to getting at the actual essence of how the Romans understood the world and how they understood these power dynamics.
Mm. Yeah, because I think there is an element, and I think we talked about this a bit in other shows that we've discussed past him, that it's, I think a lot of shows about ancient Rome in particular, because there are a lot more shows about ancient Rome and certainly a lot more that deal with the concept of ancient Roman slavery, they tend to sort of shy away from what it was actually like quite a lot, because it's hard to make that palatable to a sort of a premier prestige TV viewing audience. Mm. But it turns out that one of the ways you can make it palatable is by shooting it as though it's the Mighty Boosh.
Wank
off me, master.
You can tell.
Look
that at
I
some
found
point
myself.
There was...
I thought it was supposed to be gladiatorial school half term.
But like you can tell that I'm pretty sure that's a real discussion that they had at some point in the writer's room while they were putting this show together.
Let's make it look like the Mighty Boosh.
Okay, maybe not that part, but but they did I'm sure they had a discussion at some point that was like, people are not going to believe how bad this actually was if we just portray it exactly as it is. And I think the solution they hit on was not to soften it, it was to make it more lurid. Mm. And more exploitative and more like even the
it
sex
shall be
scenes
as lurid
in the show.
As the screen against which it is shot.
Yeah, they went That's it. That I feel like that would be such a rare thing in 2025 if you were making a TV show. Like some network would get a hold of it, and the notes you got back would be like, "This is we're not doing this. This is absurd." Mm. But in 2010 or 2009, when everybody was trying to make the next prestige TV show and they were just throwing shit at the wall, this could kind of sneak through. Mm. And they just fully committed to that bit. And yeah, it is ridiculous. It is lurid. It is all green screen. None of it looks real.
I'm looking at it and being like, why is this scene green screened? It's just two people in a room. Surely we can just put two people in a room.
Completely unnecessary. Like you couldn't do one backdrop for this.
Well, physically? You know what it kind of reminds me of a little bit? You know this thing when they invented Technicolor for putting colors in films, they really wanted to kind of show off this like brand new technology. So it was a period of like a few years, every single film had some massive fire scene in it because flames is like it's the absolute best possible way of showing off both the skills of the Technicolor artist and like the capacities of Technicolor. And that's sort of what it feels like. It feels like they've just learned about green screen, despite the fact it is not a new technology in 2010. And they're like, let's just now, can we use the green screen? In fact, Lawless, let's not have her in this scene at all. Let's have her head and then someone and then fucking Andy Serkis. Can we get him in? And he's her body. Can we do that? Is that something we can do? Can we put Gollum in this show?
You're goddamn right. That's what I love about it is it just like I love things that pretend to be slop that aren't. Mm. That's my very favorite thing in the world is something that pretends to be slop and isn't. And this is pretending to be slop and it's not. Mm. It mirrors the genre conventions of slop. And the story structures of slop, it mirrors the aesthetic of like a kind. It's kind of the aesthetic is kind of an updated version of crappy 1950s sword and sandals productions. It's very much echoing that and doing entirely different things in the same way. Like, you know what it reminds me of is like an anti-Western.
Okay.
So. Where you have the Western genre as it develops in the United States, especially through the 1920s, 30s, 40s, 50s, and it becomes a well-defined genre with well-defined tropes, stock characters, plots. Like you've got a kind of a limited range of things that you can do with it. And then in the late 1960s and into the 70s, you get a reaction against that and you get the anti-Western, best exemplified by like Sam Peckinpah making like the Wild Bunch. Mm-hmm. So something that just takes all the tropes and subverts them while keeping the visual language and the stock characters and so you still have the same elements, but the way that they're arranged is completely different. And the effect is to challenge the norms of the genre, to challenge the underlying ideas. And that's basically what they're doing here. It is an anti-sword and sandals epic.
Interesting. Have either of you ever seen that? That old version of Jason and the Argonauts?
Yes.
Yeah. I think I have.
They're working with the technology of the time. So when they have the skeleton army, it's like, it's so cute. They like, they're these little kind of like kind of puppet guys and they kind of pop up out of the sand and they're like, we are the skeleton army. And you're like, no, you're not the skeleton.
Well, they're
army.
Only on shift at off-peak times.
You're just a little guy.
Like the giant green guy in Star Trek that Captain Kirk fights.
Yeah.
The Gorn.
Oh, right, yeah.
Yeah, same vibe.
Again, a lot of the backdrops in this are quite Star Trek-y, aren't they? There's a the bit in the first episode where he's having a little naked sleep with his wife, and then the Romans come and arrest him, and then the background it looks like something from fucking the aliens from Plan 9 or something. Like it's like Thrace, which is on the moon. Apparently.
Yeah, yeah. This doesn't look much like Bulgaria.
They reused the set. Like, yeah. You can see someone kind of like hastily kind of like elbowing a kind of alien beastie out of the court. Just like, get it out of shot. Get it out of shot.
Thank God that AI wasn't around when they made this, because otherwise, when you set the background to Bulgaria, there'd be like a Volkswagen Passat TDI and like a couple of fucking shish kebab spits.
Just like a 17-year-old Bulgarian kid on steroids downing a 2-liter of Coca-Cola while driving a Passat into the side of an abandoned factory.
Oh, absolutely. guy eating a pizza that's covered in doner meat. Like,
yep, that's all, baby. It sounds like we need a trip to Bulgaria is what it sounds like.
Yeah, yeah. Official podcasting business trip to Bulgaria.
Yeah, we are investigating ancient Thrace through by slumming in modern Bulgaria. That's the... Yeah, look, it
works
for me. I
love that for us.
I think that'd work for my accountant if we wanted to expense it. So I guess, Milo, because Phoebe and I talked about this. What about this doesn't work for you? I'm really curious because it's clear how enthusiastic I am. I want to hear I want to hear why it's not working for you.
I mean, what about it works for me? It would be.
Yeah, maybe we should go with what few things are working for you.
Look, I mean, I've watched enough bad TV in my time that I can enjoy something despite it being bad. I can take in the, like, believe you me, when that Thracian soldier started talking in like a thick Brisbane accent, I was like, yeah, okay, all right. They really don't give a fuck. And I appreciate that. Yeah, it's like, I think anything that looks like shit, I find quite a difficult watch, generally. Mm-hmm. I'll forgive a lot if something looks good. Also, I mean, the dialogue is bad.
It is bad.
There's a lot of bad dialogue. The plot is confusing. But what I do sort of like is how insane it is. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, them having a conversation with each other that's a completely normal conversation while just like both being sucked off and then like throwing themselves at each other. Yeah, great. Love that. Fun.
Especially since it's just like, okay, you know what? Like we have to find some way of establishing the backdrop of enmity between Glaber the Legatus and Batiatus the gladiator school guy. And we have to demonstrate that he is planning on using this new gladiator, the Thracian Spartacus, as that leverage. But we don't want to have him just having a conversation with his wife because that's boring. We need some visual interest. And then there's this one guy just being like, okay, well, I've got a green screen and I've got an alien. Could we have that? Then Noel Fielding shows up and is like, we could do a little random song. We could just put a little random song in the middle there.
Everybody loves
a little random song. Just a little random song in there.
Imagine if they broke into song. Maybe that's the key. They need to actually lean into the absurdity more, even more.
And have a musical episode. Well, Marlo, can I just shock you? Episode 4.
They should do it like the Planet of the Apes musical in The Simpsons.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But with Noel Fielding.
Oh no, I was wrong. This was Thrace all along. Yeah, that kind of shit.
It would work. I think it would work. Yeah, it is it is gonna get weirder and more batshit. That's not gonna change. If anything, it's going to intensify over the course of this. What I hope, because Milo, none of what you're saying is at all off base. That's all 100% correct. Like, it is visually odd, not good. A lot of the dialogue is not good.
Mm.
But I would just say give it 4 or 5 episodes.
All right.
And kind of let yourself sink into the world a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And if they were constantly jumping around trying different things that were absurd or strange, it would not work at all.
Yeah.
But they make the choices and they stick to them. And if you can kind of wheel yourself into the framework that they're going with, it works better.
Yeah, I kind of respect that.
I mean, much like trying to do a Mighty Boosh rewatch in big 2025, you've sort of just got to go, okay, fine. I'm just gonna permit this to happen.
I did also watch this during the work day, which I always think gives it a less charitable view. Like, I usually watch, peep behind the curtain for the listener, I usually watch these TV shows like at night, like before bed. That's generally the time I allocate. And then I think at that time when I'm in a sort of like, you know, perisomniferous state, and I can consume it. I'm like, well, there's nothing productive I could be doing. When I'm watching this at like 11 in the morning and it's coming at like a direct opportunity cost, I'm like, for the love of God, sort the acting out.
Yeah, no, that's the wrong time. We have discussed proper contexts in which to watch these various shows. Mm. And
Stoned a lot of the time.
Yeah, and I think we came to the conclusion Barbarians is a perfectly fine sober watch. Mm-hmm. It's a perfectly fine first screen.
Yeah.
No accelerants, shall we say?
Shall we say?
Apparently I can't talk. I don't know words. Yeah. Apparently I become Sean. I become some sort of Sean Connery knockoff here. Barbarians is a perfectly comprehensible show that you could watch in the middle of the day and feel good about yourself. This is not one of those.
It's German.
Yeah.
It's measured as a kind of ruthless efficiency.
Yeah, and this is not that. This is doing something much different. This is a late night show watch after. This is the kind of show that you should put on and enjoy the shit out of after you've had 3-4 drinks
on a random
Wednesday night, and you come home and you're like, I am going to watch 2 episodes of Spartacus.
Yeah, drink 7 Miller Lights and then consume Spartacus. I actually, do you know what this? I think there is something powerfully American about it, and I think we've watched a lot of British made ancient Rome TV shows, and what it really reminded of, it had the aesthetics of like a show that they would have had on Bravo in 2007. Mm-hmm. Like, it was really reminding me heavily of like Valerie Iron's Protection, or like really getting Dog the Bounty Hunter vibes from
Well, I mean, it was broadcast on Stars, and like, and you know when you've got that extraneous Z, you know that there's some quality programming coming your way.
Stars, I believe, make Outlander, which is
But they made Outlander. So all of the like popular shows Stars made, and there have been some, were after this.
Right.
This was their first attempt at making a real TV series. As far as I can remember, as someone who lived the age of prestige TV in real time, to my knowledge, this was the first one they really tried. And their subsequent efforts in making genre things were substantially higher budget. So the ones that came after this were like Black Sails, outstanding show. So good. And not at all done in this visual style. Outlander, same deal. Like, I haven't watched much of Outlander, but it doesn't look like this, you know?
Oh, insane plot, dialogue, and concept. Outlander is like, it's mum porn, but...
Oh.
We'll get on to that.
That doesn't sound bad. That's that. Yeah. Tell me more.
Oh, no, it's porn for mums, not porn of mums.
I know. Milo, you got to understand your audience, bro. come on, man. That's the...
Is Outlander the one with the your man with the curly hair and the blouse?
Yeah.
You're going to need to be more specific. Yeah.
It's also like the founding premise of Outlander essentially is that like Scottish people from 400 years ago are really attractive. And I think it's a premise that comes into collision with reality pretty hard. Like, you know, I'm not going to say that English people are 400 years ago were anything great to look at either, but it strikes me as an odd starting premise.
Yeah, that one immediately takes me out. Like, if the visual language of this show is a turnoff for you, the premise of Scottish people 400 years ago being hot, I can't buy into that.
Okay, this is not what I think it is. I'm confusing this with something else.
Mm. Yeah, there's a lot of curly-haired men in blouses these days, Phoebe. And for the most part, I would say that's a positive development in gender relations, but it does make this specific task more confusing.
There should be more blouses than this.
I'd like a blouse.
I'm confusing it with Poldark.
Oh, yeah. It is also quite curly-haired man in a blouse, though. It's just a different
Different type, different side of the wall. Did you know that Poldark's first name is Ross? Ross
Poldark. Only experience of Poldark is being on the PBS app one time. I pay for the premium PBS app in the United States.
What does the P stands for?
Yeah, that's public broadcasting, baby. Mm. Nothing free. Nothing free in this country. And I got really, really high one night and started to watch Poldark and fell asleep 2 minutes in. And then I was like, this is clearly not doing it for me. And I never went back to it. That was my only experience.
But why is he called Ross? Is he a personal trainer or an estate agent?
Maybe.
You can't That's just what he's doing cut when he's around not in the 19th coat. Century being like, oh, my name's Ross. Are you joking?
Mm-hmm.
No.
No, his parents just watched a lot of Friends.
This is a lovely little workman's cottage, dual aspect. Yeah, no, I just got back from the American War of Independence, yeah.
It's so funny.
Keeps you busy over there.
I never think of Ross from Friends as being called Ross in the way that a British person is called Ross.
Yeah.
Huh.
He's got a horse that's like liveried with like, you know, Right Move on the side or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
His horse has its own stag do nickname and it's got it written on his side of his horse blanket.
Mm. So a lot of people did work in recruitment in those days, to be fair, but they were mostly just putting shillings in your pint.
I have a blouse note about this show.
All right.
One of the things that I like about the visuals of this show, and this is
one of the things.
This is actually completely consonant with what you were talking about, Milo.
Okay.
And what bothers you about it is that a lot of it looks cheap. And I actually like that because I think a lot of the Roman world, if we were actually looking at it, looked cheap.
Yeah.
And
it's quite like
garish.
Fancy dress shop, isn't it?
Yeah. If you look at the wall paintings from Pompeii, a lot of them, despite being quite masterful works of art, nonetheless kind of look like shit because they're like too much. The colors that the Romans and the Greeks, too, for that matter, the colors they liked were all very bright. And they kind of clashed. And to our eyes, they would look garish.
Oh, it's like if you go into
tasteless.
An Italian or Greek home now.
I wasn't going to go there, but if you'd like to indulge in some casual Mediterranean racism, Milo, who am I to stop you?
They're white now.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, I still, you want to call them Dagos while you're at it? Like, what's Jesus.
I don't know. This is sort of an aside, but my sister for years when I was young went out with an Italian guy who was like the Essex equivalent of New Jersey Italian guy. Really nice guy.
Shit.
His parents, both from Sicily, he used to say that his mum, whilst she couldn't speak English very well, couldn't really speak Italian very well either. He was like, you know, she just communicates in a language that's all of her own. It's like a hybrid of both. His dad was like a little bit more like kind of like switched on. He spoke English pretty well. Anyway, they had this statue of the Virgin Mary in their porch, which was very important to his mother, who was a very devout Catholic. And I think his dad couldn't really give a fuck. Anyway, one day, me and my sister happened to be around at their house. The statue of the Virgin Mary has been stolen from the porch by some sort of, you know, local ne'er-do-wells. And, you know, Conchetta is storming around the house. She's like, I hope God strikes him down. Like this level of like vitriol. And then Antonio like calmly walks into the kitchen with his slippers on, his hands in his pockets, and goes, I got nowhere to put my screwdriver. And it turned out that he was like storing his screwdrivers behind this statue of the Virgin Mary. And he was engaging with this issue on a completely different level. All of which is to say, the interior of that house was crazy.
Right. Okay.
Did
she ever get her statue back?
I don't know.
Oh.
I feel like it was porcelain. I feel like it probably wouldn't have survived very well.
Once that fucker's gone, you're not coming back.
They love crazy china. I stayed in a house in Sicily once where they had a gigantic ashtray that was from a neuroscience conference that had been held in Italy somewhere.
I mean, while I too am a fan of the cognitive benefits of nicotine, I'm not sure I would have gone to that specific bit of merch from the neuroscience conference.
I'm just imagining a bunch of brain surgeons just like hacking darts sitting around this giant commemorative neuroscience ashtray. Incredible.
I used to have a Virgin Mary ashtray, which was made out of lava from Mount Etna.
That's actually that's baller as
well. Yeah, that is sick.
Which I bought from a shop on the edge of Mount Etna because we were there on a school trip, and it was late spring, so the weather was beautiful, perfect. And our teachers thought it would be really funny not to warn any of us that if you go up Mount Etna, it's fucking cold. It's really, really cold. And they didn't think that this was like useful information. So when we were like on the coach, like all of our teachers are wearing these like puffer jackets and stuff. And we're like, oh, look at these dickheads. And then as soon as we get out, we're like, oh, what the fuck? What is happening? It's so
altitude,
cold.
Altitude, baby.
It's so fucking cold. So we sort of stopped off halfway up. So halfway up, there's this little kind of thing with like kind of gift shops and stuff. And they had this very, very fiery red liqueur. And which like everyone's like just like chucking back, trying to warm themselves. And that and there was this gift shop which only sold like religious ephemera made out of lava.
And you got a Virgin Mary ashtray.
I got a Virgin Mary ashtray. It had
like,
had like kind of glittery flowers, like kind of round her feet. I have no idea what happened to that ashtray.
See, I would love an ashtray like that. We still have one. My dad has used it to put his keys in for the last 25 years that it has a little picture of Cicero on it. It's from the Hotel Cicero in Rome, which was the first place we went to. And my dad has never been a guy to like take things from a hotel, but he really liked the Cicero ashtray and he took that from the Hotel Cicero. So if you're listening to this and you're an employee of the Hotel Cicero and you've been missing an ashtray for 25 years, it's been on my dad's nightstand.
George's dad.
I'm the employee of the Hotel Cicero who's been deputized to recover. I'm in the loss prevention department of the Hotel Cicero and I'm going to nail your dad's hands to the door of the hotel.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm going to keep that ashtray forever.
Oh yeah,
that's never going anywhere. I love that.
Absolutely should. Yeah, George's dad a little while ago. Well, I say a little while ago, like over a period of years, stole just an astonishing number of pint glasses from a local pub, and I can't remember the circumstances in which this happened, but at some point or another, he offered to give them back. He like kind of offered up this like kind of pint glass amnesty. And they were like, no, we don't. What are you talking about? No, of course we don't.
They get them for free from the brewery.
Of course we don't. Of course we don't want them. I can't remember why he, you know what? That has the status of a really, really incomplete anecdote because I can't remember why he tried to send them back.
Just wanted to repatriate them, like the Elgin marbles.
Yeah, I think it might have been like at least partly that.
Yeah, the pub leaving a little space on the shelf for the pint glasses that aren't there.
And like someone pointed out that pub was being used as like a gunpowder storage house. So really, if he hadn't taken the pint glasses, they would have all been destroyed.
George's dad has sent us some of his pint glasses on loan so that we can display them for 6 weeks.
George's dad is Lord Elgin. This is what people don't realize.
Yeah, it's the negotiations for the return. It's like trying to get the Benin bronzes back. It's just the whole thing.
It's a whole nightmare. What should we do by way of wrapping up? What are our final thoughts?
I have a final thought. I don't have my usual list of complaints because just because I'm really enjoying it, so I don't have like complaints in the same way. My only two observations is number one, I'm really, really enjoying the absolutely honking acting from Glaber's wife.
Oh.
Absolutely, simply love it. The one who is like who's like turning in a performance like a kind of like you know the secondary Bond girl in an early 60s Bond film.
Oh, yeah.
Who dies really, really early on. That's what she's like. You know, one of those girls who has like some kind of sort of semi-vaginal nickname. That's the one of like
Pussy Galore.
One of those, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like Flange Fitzgerald is is the one that she's sort of talking about.
Yeah. Cervix Ladorum.
And she sort of turns up, she's like, oh, have you never seen a gladiator before? Oh, I love the gladiators. Oh, look at them. They're all so grubby. And that's fantastic. I fucking love that. And the second one is, so he's made a gladiator friend at gladiator school. First they're a bit shy, but then they share some bread.
It's really cute when they bring their first friend home from gladiator school.
Have you made any nice friends at gladiator school? Oh, Mom, shut up. Have you? It's very important.
On the palaestra, okay? I'll tell you what, you go straight up to the biggest boy in there.
You're complaining now, but these are the best years of your life at gladiator school.
They're not taking the mick out of you for your lunchbox. They're jealous of your lunchbox, okay?
No, I'm not getting you a new one. You loved Ben 10 last year.
Ben X, as he was known. Benedictus X.
Benedictus X. Yeah, there we go. Yeah,
the Roman Ben 10.
So yeah, he makes a little friend, and the little friend is a freedman who's in lots of debt, and has handed himself in as a kind of debt bondsman to the gladiatorial school in order to make sure that his wife and child are kind of provided for. And honestly, if I was in a Sword and Sandals TV show and somebody shows up and he seems like a nice enough guy and he starts talking about his wife and his little son, the first thing I'd do would just be like, you know what? You get away from me. I don't want to be friends with you because you've just cursed yourself. There's no point being friends with you because you're going to fucking die. You're going to fucking die horribly in order to advance my personal emotional narrative arc. You get away from me. You go sit over there.
Whatever the opposite of plot armor is, he has.
Yeah.
He has a like, plot Achilles. He is a physical plot Achilles tendon.
Yeah. That's literally
boss vulnerable spot.
Yeah. he's got a fucking like kind of flashing siren above his head, just like going, oh, rah, rah, rah. And like everyone's like, shh, 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 you need to, we're hiding from the plot. And then this kind of, you know, sort of cheerful, curly blonde guy just shows up going like, what? Ooh, ooh, ooh. He can't see me, can he?
Don't you know they're looking for you?
They're gonna kill you, man. You're fucking dickhead. Stop, turn the siren off. What? You want me to what? You want me to turn the fuck? I can't hear you.
I can't hear you over the plot.
I can't hear you over my siren. It's pretty loud.
This is shockingly perfect. And without giving too much away, also just completely accurate. I think one of the really surprising things that you would not believe, if this is your first time going through this show and watching it, considering that this episode is our introduction to a lot of faces that we're going to see for quite a while in this show, how attached as a viewer you're going to get to them. So even knowing that, right? Like even knowing that that guy is not going anywhere good as a viewer, these people are going to kind of grow on you in ways that are surprising. Mm. Like even Crixus, who looks like, I mean, a lot of gratuitous cock shots here. But of Crixus, which, you know, I'm all for equality.
Thank you, Pat. We appreciate it.
I am an ally.
Me and the women community appreciate it.
I was talking to the gays, Phoebe. even that dude who comes across in this episode like the absolute most wooden, dumbest, poorly written character you can come up with. He has an arc, and the arc works.
Mm-hmm.
And I can fully understand if, as a viewer, this is your first time watching this show, we're on episode two, you look at that and you think that's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. I get it. I 100% get it. But trust me, you'll go with it. And if you come on this journey with us, you will end up someplace that is quite surprising and interesting.
There you go. You heard it here first.
There you go.
Thank you so much for being a Patreon subscriber. You make the show possible. Without you, it's just 39 minutes of gossip that you can't hear. So thanks very much.
Which, while not bad, is also not monetizable.
Yeah, exactly. So thank you for making it monetizable. Please come and see me in Ireland. If you're in Ireland, I'm doing a bunch of tour dates there. I'm doing Bristol. And also, very importantly, there's a show on the 19th of June in London for Refugee Action, where we have so many tickets to sell. So if you would like to prove that you have £25 that you're willing to to exchange for some laughs and the welfare of refugees, then come to that. I'll put my generic website gigs link in the thing. Thanks very much. Catch you all later. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.